Welcome to the Nerd Party.
This has been a most unusual day. Love has made me see things in a different way.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames, everybody. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. I'm very excited for this episode because we have none other than Lee Hutchison in the proverbial studio. I don't know if proverbial is the right word. Is that the right word?
I'll give you a free pass on that. I'm the guest. I can't get away with kind of pointing out all your flaws on the first episode.
We'll make that work.
Yep, good enough for me.
Well, perfect. So we're good. We're here. We're making it happen. And the magic is happening, beaming all the way in. I think I'm so excited mainly because of your accent. I think the problem with Missing Frames is we haven't had enough diversity in our accents. It's all been very boring, very American. So I'm glad you could be here to kind of shake that up a bit.
Yeah, the British accent always makes something sound more classy. And it gives like any podcast a stamp of approval from a global audience.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking as well. So we got the diversity card. We're good. Stop sending me your angry emails about how we lack diversity. But no one does that.
Every Scottish person will listen to this show and stuff. It's such a small country. Only like five of us have the internet anyway. So if there's if one of us is on the internet, the other four tune in. So yeah, prepare to have a big spike in your listener numbers.
I can't wait. It's going to be great. But we want to kick things off, first of all, by talking a little bit about the Nerd Party. First of all, if you haven't already, make sure you're following the Nerd Party at Join Nerd Party. You can also follow me at Yay Shonderman and chat it up with us, or chat it up with me. Lee, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on the Filibuster podcast. Me and you have not quite managed to get ourselves together on that yet, but you're on there plenty of times talking about Spider-Man and Dunkirk, and I'm here and there talking with some other people. So one day we'll cross the streams there too.
It'll be beautiful. And in the meantime, we're just going to go ahead and look at our subject for today, which is Luc Besson's, I don't know, he's French, Besson. I'll just pronounce it like that, Besson. I think Besson is the correct French pronunciation, but I'm just going to say Besson because that is how I'm going to say it. We're going to be looking at his film Leon the Professional, which I don't know if that was his breakthrough technically. I know, didn't he do La Femme Nikita?
No. Did he? No, I don't think so.
He didn't.
Did he?
He did
work on it in some way?
I'm gonna pull it up. He did do it. Okay, I wanted to make sure because I saw Nikita in his filmography.
What did he do with
it? I was like,
it?
I think that's that. He directed it.
Did he?
Isn't that crazy? Oh, and another fun fact. This has got to be the same. This has nothing to do with Leon the Professional. But Eric Serra did the music for La Femme Nikita. And he also did GoldenEye, the soundtrack to GoldenEye, which is a very distinctive soundtrack.
Distinctive is a unique way to put it.
Yes, distinctive 90s, very 90s is another unique way to put it.
Sounds like the Pierce Brosnan era of Bond summed up in a winner. Very 90s.
But he did that. And then I guess Leon the Professional was... I feel like that is the one I hear the most about. It's that and The Fifth Element. And I haven't seen either of them. I haven't seen any of his movies, to be completely honest. What about you?
Yeah, I've seen a few. I've seen The Fifth Element. Hang on, let me get up this thing here. I've seen The Fifth Element. I've seen Lucy was the more recent one I've seen.
I didn't even realize he did that one. I keep forgetting about that.
It's like the first quarter of that film is really good, then it just goes all to hell. Arthur and the Invisibles, I forgot he was involved in that for some bizarre reason.
And you know what else? He's looking at his filmography, he's been like a producer on so much. Like, he's been on the Transporter movies with Jason Statham, all the way to I Love You, Philip Morris with Ewan McGregor and Jim Carrey.
And the Taken TV series as well. I don't know what that's. I didn't even realize there was a Taken TV series.
Well, he was involved with the movies as well. So I would hope he would be involved in the TV series too. But yeah, as far as his directorial efforts go, it seems like they all fall in the same lines. I don't know. Now that I'm looking at it, I'm starting to get very confused by what I'm expecting from this man.
Apart from like the Fifth Element, it all kind of looks like, well, I suppose excluding Arthur, it's a lot of it seems to be about American actors or foreign actors transplanted into kind of French movies or stories in a way, because Lucy's like that. It starts off in Asia and then ends up in France, and then we've obviously got Joan of Arc,
right.
Leon. Does that take place in France? I suppose we're going to find out.
Yeah, I guess we will. I honestly have no clue, and that's the way it should be. Ignorance is bliss. But I think I honestly don't know. I wonder if that was his first his feature debut as far as an American release, because it feels like it did have kind of some traction over here. I mean, it had a pretty made money. I know that much. It did pretty well at the box office. It made about $46 million on a $16 million budget. So,
and then imagine George Lucas must have watched it as well. So that's definitely someone.
That's always George Lucas's seal of approval is guaranteed success for you, especially
I can imagine him in his flannel shirt just in the back of a cinema screen just going, this is fine.
He's like, yeah, very good, very good. So there's that. There's that to look forward to. But so you've seen The Fifth Element. You've seen Lucy. Is there any, like, so what can you tell me about, what just based on that, what do you expect? What can I expect? What should I brace myself for? I know Fifth Element just looks bonkers, the little I've seen of it.
Yeah. I think this is probably going to be a more traditional movie than probably what's to come from his, well, what his career ended up being with things like The Fifth Element ended up like 3 years later, Angel A, kind of Arthur and the Invisibles, like a family comedy, Lucy, these sorts of movies, and Valarin, I mean, someone's got to have seen it. They all look like very all over the place movies, genre movies.
Yeah.
Kind of Leon, I get the idea it's a very sort of traditional kind of action movie drama. That's kind of what I'm expecting.
That's sort of what I'm expecting too. I mean, I know Jean Rousseau, like I think the only thing I can recall seeing him in, and this is terrible, is Godzilla and Mission Impossible. So
yeah, I had a feeling you were going to say Godzilla.
So that's like very clearly where my interests were in the mid 90s when he was making those movies. I've heard nothing but like amazing things. Like everyone's like, oh my God, he's amazing. Leon the Professional is incredible. You've got to see his performance in that movie. I can't think, like, I feel like this is like his big thing. Like I haven't heard that. I mean, you would think people would talk about his performance in Godzilla just a little bit more. It's the only thing salvageable in that entire film. But
he was in Pink Panther 2 as well. So, you know, there's always that too.
I see. So just instead of Leon the Professional 2, just do the Pink Panther 2 instead.
Exactly.
Good.
Steve Martin and Jean Reno and Natalie Portman and Jean. It's an interesting double pairing.
Exactly. We should just make this a double feature episode and watch Leon the Professional and Pink Panther 2 and pretend Pink Panther 2 is a sequel to this one. But
I can't think of a better way to spend my summer.
But I've been excited to see this. My wife Sarah, she loves this movie. A lot of people I've talked to really love it. It's funny because it has like a 71% on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that Rotten Tomatoes is the end all be all of whether or not a film is good, but
okay, Zach.
I thought it would be higher than that for some reason, because I feel like it has such a classic status.
Yeah, like I suppose I'm not too sure of what people think of it. I always just know that like people enjoy this movie and think highly of it. And you know, when I think of the movie, like I know there's a car chase in it, and there's always been some talk about there's like a slightly kind of uneasy sort of relationship between this older character and Natalie Portman's younger kids, that some people have kind of talked it's maybe a bit kind of comes across like perhaps a bit of a pedophile sort of relationship.
That's what I've heard too. I've heard
that. So
Roger Ebert, I think in his review specifically, he was like, I'm uncomfortable. I admire the film, but I'm not sure how I'm supposed to feel about this.
Yeah, so I'm curious to see what that's like, kind of knowing them both as sort of mature adult characters, kind of going back to it and seeing whether that is justified or whether it's just people have got, you know, look at these things perhaps with a slightly more cynical view.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably very sensationalized at the time. And it was Natalie Portman. It was her first movie. This is her debut feature. I thought, wasn't she in Heat as well? I guess this is before
Heat.
Yeah,
she was in Heat. She was the daughter.
Well, there you go. I'm excited to see it. I don't know if she got nominated for anything for this. I feel like, I don't think this got any awards attention.
No, I wouldn't have thought so.
No. It did well at the Caesar Awards, you know. But nobody counts those. Those don't mean anything. Not here in America.
It's up there with the Indie Spirit Awards.
But yeah, so yeah, I've been wanting to watch this, and you know, I actually, as ridiculous as it looked, I was really kind of hoping for the best with Valerian. I the second I saw that preview, I was like, oh my god, that's the bomb of the summer, and you just knew it. You could feel it. But I kind of admired just Luc Besson's gall, just making this original $200 million budget movie in the midst of a summer of blockbusters like Spider-Man and, you know, you got Dunkirk and all that stuff. And I wanted it to do well. And then when it didn't do well critically or financially, I was like, well, maybe I can just ease the pain by, instead of supporting that film, watching a film that people are a little bit more unanimous in their praise for.
Yeah, like, it never appealed to me either with the trailers. I looked at it and I thought that, what's her name, Cara Devine,
yeah,
you, Sarah? Like, I watched her and think, she can't act, and just
no,
like,
she always seems, the thing is, her and Dane DeHaan, they both seem like they don't want to be there, and that seems like a movie where, like, you need to have the investment of the actors in order for it to work. You need them to be ready to play ball. And neither of them seem like it.
Though I'm looking at the IMDb page, and I notice Ethan Hawke is cast as Jolly the Pimp. Now, I have immediately now decided I want to see this movie. And, yeah, like, I was like, I didn't even notice him in the trailer. So Jolly the Pimp. So I will be watching that when it comes on Netflix.
I'm waiting for the Cinematic Universe spinoff movie, Jolly the Pimp. Ethan Hawke.
Exactly.
I'm ready for it. I'm ready for an Oscar nod. A long overdue Oscar win for Ethan
Hawke.
But yeah, so I would say my interest in Leon the Professional, bringing it all back home before we break to watch this movie. I am excited to see this. I hope it's good. I really don't know what to expect, but it's got a great cast. Gary Oldman's in it, and I just watched True Romance, and he was in that as well.
Oh, yeah.
He was great in that. I presume he plays a villain in this movie, because he has kind of top billing with Jean Renault, so I guess he's a villain.
If it's anything pre Batman Begins, always assume Gary Oldman's a villain or a psychopath.
That's exactly a sex offender,
a murderer. Always assume the worst about Gary Oldman.
I mean, in True Romance, he played a white black man, so that was a pleasant surprise to see him do that. But
hands across the divide.
Exactly. But no, I'm excited. I am looking forward to watching this. This is going to be my first Luc Besson movie. I hope I enjoy it, because I do want to watch The Fifth Element at some point. And maybe someday I'll see Valerian. Who knows? What about you, Lee? How do you feel?
I'm ready to dive into this. I'm really excited to see if at long last I'm going to watch this movie. And I'm excited.
Perfect. Well, let's go ahead and get to it, and we will be back.
Now available to own on video cassette.
Okay, we're back. We are enlightened now because we've just watched Leon the Professional. Lee, you have the first half of Leon's name. How does that make you feel?
I feel that I'm happy now for having watched the movie. So I feel like I'm in a good place. But I have a question I also want to ask you.
All right.
Which version did you watch? Did you watch the international cut, or did you watch the cinema edition?
That's a good question. I watched just the default cut on my Blu-ray, so I don't even know. Is there an easy way to tell the difference?
Well, was it like over 2 hours?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so that was the international cut.
Oh, there you go. All right.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get into what the big differences are. And I think we can already imagine what those differences are.
Well, okay, so overall thoughts.
I really liked it a lot, and I'm glad I finally watched it and I had an excuse to watch it. I think it's high praise of the cult kind of acclaim it's got, and I think the kind of conception I had
of this movie being slightly dubious about some of its views on relationships was in fact quite wrong, and it's a much more subtle and should be applauded movie.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I don't know if I loved it, but it was constantly entertaining and involving, and it was just completely wacky. Like, I mean, the filmmaking style is very energetic, which I kind of expected, but, you know, the performances were great, and just the concept of it. I don't know exactly how Luc Besson came up with it, but I imagine he probably went with the concept of, like, a 12-year-old hit girl being trained by a seasoned assassin. And that concept is so striking and strong that it could almost carry a movie. I feel like I don't know. I enjoyed it. It something about it. Maybe we'll discover it as we discuss. I don't know if I completely embrace it, but I did enjoy it. At what point were you kind of like, all right, I'm good to go. I'm on board. Like, when. Was it pretty early on? For me, it was pretty early. I was into it from the get-go.
Yeah, I mean, I was fairly into it straight away, and it's kind of weird watching it now as opposed to then, because maybe it's just me, but I'm watching it and I'm thinking, like, I'm almost viewing Natalie Portman as an adult, and I'm thinking, oh, Natalie Portman's taking on her biggest role yet, playing a young child. And it's like, oh man, Natalie Portman is nailing playing this young child. It was hard to think of her as Natalie Portman, this is her debut movie, as opposed to thinking this is Natalie Portman playing a role, and that role is this young kid. It's clearly my head.
Yeah, she's shockingly good in this movie. Like, it's no surprise in the slightest that she had a career after this. It's like everything, it's an extremely complex role, and I don't know what I expected. I'd heard good things about her performance, but I mean, I never once did I think of her. You kind of watch movies with kids, and there are certain performances where you're like, oh, well, cut them some slack. They're a kid. They don't quite know. And then there are other performances where you're like, oh, all right. Well, do you want the Oscar now or later? And this feels like one of those performances. And I mean, I know we discussed in the pre-show, this didn't really get any awards attention. And again, it's probably because of the arguably disturbing content of an assassin training a 12-year-old. But I mean, she's incredible in this movie. And Jean Renault is as well. I mean, they're both great and they have great chemistry. But I think Natalie Portman may be the standout here for me in this one.
Yeah, I mean, she steals the show. I think, like, she's the whole role she inhibits is just that it's funny, it's touching, it's sweet, it's mature. Like, it's such an incredible performance. Like, you could, there is a reality out there where she could win an Oscar for a role like this, that, you know, you see movies over the years where young child actors like Abigail Breslin for kind of Little Miss Sunshine got nominated. Yeah. Like, I think there's probably a bit of snobbery that kind of maybe would stop her getting nominated for this sort of movie. I can't imagine many of the older white Oscar voters of past would have been watching this going, ah, yes, yes, this is a fantastic film, ticking the box off.
Though they should. They should, those old monsters. But yeah, so I, right off the bat, you kind of, Besson announces his style. I've got to figure out how should I say Besson for this episode, because I feel like every time I say it, I'm going to say it wrong.
I always thought of it as Luc Besson.
Luc Besson. I'm going to say Besson.
I've thrown, like, if we're getting in trouble, at least you can throw the guest under the water. Under the bus, sorry.
That's right. No, you're good. Under the water, under the bus, all of the above. So Besson, he kind of announces his style, even from the opening credits. Like, I remember being very struck by, like, the way it kind of, the camera is panning through the city very dramatically, and then it very dramatically pans into a door, and not pans, but pushes into it. And I was like, all right, well, we are clearly in the hands of a very stylistic director. And then the opening scene with Leon just kind of taking out everybody just reinforces that. And I was like, oh, this is great. This is so much fun. And this is just insane watching him kind of run around and take all these people out.
I kind of liked how, like, it was hard not to think of it. Like, it felt like a real throwback to the early 90s in a way, that kind of when it opened with the credits and this, like, going across the ocean into New York, into Manhattan, you were like, it really took you back to those kind of 90s things where it opens like fade in, see, we're moving in towards the city. And there was no need for them to, like, start all that way out in the ocean. But it just reminded me of that 90s trait that always seemed to happen. And obviously the score as well really kind of dates it as well.
Speaking of the soundtrack, I mean, this is Eric Serra, who did GoldenEye, and that was the following year. And I swear to God, this has at least 90% of GoldenEye's musical cues.
100%. Like I love GoldenEye. I'm not a big fan of the score. Obviously, the score kind of doesn't really divide
tremendously,
much opinion.
Yeah.
But it was like, I was like, oh yeah, that's the cue when they go to Russia. That's the cue where it's like, it's so kind of trans.
Yeah, just that
obvious.
Like, the little jingle, the sleigh bells, and like the kind of echoey sort of tones, and then at the very end, when Matilda is in the helicopter and it's playing this like down down down, I was like, that's the end credit song from GoldenEye, that terrible end credit song, and I was gonna lose it if that's the same song they played at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
Has anyone else noticed this? Like, I feel like I've never. I mean, maybe people just aren't as crazy as we are, but like I feel like that's. I'm sure
there would have been hot takes on it at the time. I'm sure if there was internet blogs around about the score and comparisons. Like, I think there was a song I think they had for the end of Leon that they never used, and I think they ended up using it for the end of GoldenEye. I could be wrong.
That's got to be it. I can't even. But yeah, so we start off with that great scene kind of setting the moment or the mood, and you got, it's fun, it's fast paced, you've kind of established that Leon is awesome, and then you kind of cut to Matilda and her troubled life, and the actor playing her dad looks so familiar. Do you remember what he was in? Because I didn't even look him up while we were watching it,
no,
but I know
I'm
I've seen him
sure.
in other stuff. So he was in Raging Bull, he was in let me see, I know I've seen him, You've Got Mail, Oh Brother Where Art Thou, that's probably where I'm thinking of him. Oh Brother Where Art Thou. So yeah, he's been in a
good
couple
save
of
it you know it was
movies.
You've Got Mail, you're lying. You and Sarah have been watching
love,
it. We know. That's never going to be an episode of Missing Takes. That's like a refresh takes.
I would love to do it. I actually genuinely love You've Got Mail. That's like one of, I adore that movie. It's ridiculous. It's, I don't know if you've seen Undeclared. This is a completely different tangent. But when, have you seen the show Undeclared?
No, I've not, no.
Oh, it's fantastic. So Charlie Hunnam and, I can't remember the other actor's name. There's this whole... Oh, it's Seth Rogen. They're fighting about You've Got Mail because Seth Rogen wants to show Charlie the movie. And Charlie, he has his accent. He's from the UK, so he does not click at all with it. And they have this huge fight about it, and they end up like having a slap fest, and it's hysterical. And then at the end, Charlie Hunnam, because Seth Rogen's been talking about, how can you not like that movie? Greg Kinnear, he's so likable in that movie. And at the very end, they kind of resolve their differences, and Charlie Hunnam says, you know what? Greg Kinnear is quite likable.
Everyone loves Greg Kinnear.
It's true. So there you go. You've Got Mail, the movie we just watched for Missing Frames. no. So, yeah, I mean, I just watched True Romance, which is also another kind of shockingly violent movie. But this movie has, like, an entire family getting blown away, and not just, like, subtext. You actually see it. Like, you actually see it happen.
You were asking me, like, the moment I got into this movie. Like, I was enjoying it at the beginning, but see the moment where the person in the bath, like, that, where the shot from above comes in, blast them, and you see their face, like, all in that one take. I was like, I'm on board. You've got me. Thank you.
That was great. You know, I'm starting to think I might have seen the, I'm looking at the plot and some of the trivia on this movie. I think I might have just watched the theatrical cut. It did feel a little short. I'd watched the internet. So now we're going to have two differing opinions. How about that?
Yeah, especially because a lot more of the second, like the extended international cut, is a lot more about the relationship between the two and her feelings towards him.
Okay. All right. Well, this is going to be interesting. So that sequence was awful. First of all, not awful in a bad way, but just awful to watch. It was like, oh my God. All right. Well, we're totally doing this. We're going to kill children. All right. But Gary Oldman is wonderful. Just terrible. As this guy, what's the guy's name? Stansfield. Man, it's so funny. Cause again, I just watched True Romance, and this is, that's another great, like, horrific performance by Gary Oldman, and it's just two in a row. I think I need to start having a running theme of Gary Oldman playing a horrible villain in my movies.
Yeah, you're never going to get too... It's never going to be too difficult. Because I was saying in the pre-show bit, like, Gary Oldman, pretty much until Batman, always played horrible characters. Like, if you're ever looking for someone that was a killer, you know, a sex offender, all these different... You could think of the worst things ever. Someone would just go, Gary Oldman? And I think that's why... I think people forget it was a bit of a shock when he was cast as... his name escapes me from Batman.
Gordon.
When he was cast as Gordon in Batman. Because, like, that wasn't the type of characters he was kind of going for. You would always assume, like, oh, Gary Oldman, oh, who's he going to be playing as the villain? Like, this was... Yeah. This is what he was doing.
You know what I think it was is... this is kind of a spoiler, but I'm sure you don't mind. But... Prisoner of Azkaban, the third Harry Potter movie. Oh, he was before Batman Begins, and he transitions from being the villain of that movie to being one of Harry's like father figures by the end of the movie. Like it's like you think he's a terrible, horrible murderer, and then he turns out to be Harry's godfather. And,
as someone that's only seen like two Harry Potter movies, living in Edinburgh, the birthplace of Harry Potter, no spoilers have never escaped me. I'm aware of every little thing. I feel like I've read the books without ever watching them.
Well, there you go. So that is, I think maybe that's Gary Oldman in film form informing the audience, like, here's my transition from being the evil, horrible person you think you know to like the good, wonderful father figure that I will play in all movies moving forward.
It was maybe when he got his brains eaten in Hannibal that was the turnaround. Like, they ate out all the evil in him.
That's probably it. But, yeah, in this movie, he's pure evil. And he's great. I mean, he's great. I've sing his praises all the time. But it's fascinating to watch, to go back and watch him in these early movies as he's still kind of establishing himself as an actor, play these, like, really, really twisted characters with these fascinating, like, quirks and... personality traits, and just him like taking his pill and then freaking out, and the way he I remember when the father, after they've killed everybody, the father is in the corner of the room, and the way he kind of snakes through that like wall of the hanging jewels or whatever you want to call it, he kind of like puts his hands through it, and the way he opens it is so, it's so fascinating. But again, only someone as beautiful as Gary Oldman would come up with something that crazy.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a lot of improvisation going on behind the scenes, that like they would do multiple takes, and that he just like, he got in his face because he was like, I'm just gonna do that. And like how uncomfortable that actor looked was because he genuinely felt uncomfortable with Gary Oldman just breezing into his space.
Oh, I know. And I mean, likewise for Natalie Portman when he traps her in the bathroom and he's like right up on her and basically like stroking her face and her mouth, and it's like, oh my god, this is terrifying.
And I think what's quite good about it is that he does it like that, and it's that menacing thing that you almost, you know, when you're like in trouble with your parents and you know you're gonna get in trouble, and
yeah,
like, it's like, oh, it's not happening yet, and it's coming, and it that tension just automatically, like, oh, you're talking about Italian food or Chinese food, and you're like, oh no, like that. It's always the people that you're just waiting for them. They're like this, a snake ready to pounce.
Right. No, that's exactly it. And he personifies that perfectly in this movie. But yeah, so I really, this is going to be very interesting as far as what scenes you saw versus what I saw, because I'm very interested to hear what these additional scenes are. I must have both cuts on the Blu-ray, because the Blu-ray, I thought, I was like, oh gosh, this movie's 133 minutes long. It says it on the back, the runtime is 133 minutes, but it must have just defaulted to the theatrical version. But I loved so the scene where Matilda comes home and finds, like, she kind of walks by and is like, oh yeah, I'm heading down this way to see my friend, and realizes what's going on. I just remember that moment where it's like close on her face and she's like begging Leon to open the door. That was the moment where I was like, oh my god, give this woman an Oscar 10, 11, 12 years later. That was a big moment for me, because that gave me kind of an emotional end to the movie. Because it was very stylized, and it was very like, yeah, we're very grungy and gritty, and you're going to want to stay on your toes here. But that was the first time where you get a real emotional feel for what this movie is kind of going to be about as far as their relationship.
Yeah, and I think that was what was so good about it. Like, I've kind of read up, because obviously it's hard for us because we've never watched these movies before, so whatever we've watched is always the first time. So
yeah,
kind of based on maybe these will ring a bell, that these are kind of the differences, because obviously, like, the international cut obviously implies everywhere but America. So I read up on the movie, and what they went with was that a lot of the scenes tested differently in kind of America. So despite all the scandal in American news, like, the idea that these two, like, young child and adult were close but nothing sexual made audiences feel uncomfortable, and like the feedback was pretty off, like pretty poor towards the movie in the screenings. So apparently the international version amplifies the relationship between Leon and Matilda. There's a Russian roulette scene. Did you see that?
No, I didn't get that scene.
Oh god, well, we'll definitely need to go into that one. A situation where Matilda tries to seduce Leon, additional scenes of Leon training Matilda in assassination methods, the pair hitting the home of a drug dealer and torching his stash, Matilda drinking in a restaurant, and other scenes that American audiences didn't like. Though nothing sexual occurs between the characters, Americans felt the scenes were too sexually, pedophilic, or mature to involve a child, so they were removed from the American release. I mean, the Russian roulette scene is intense. Like, to give you an idea that obviously it's hard to know because obviously we saw these different versions, but yeah. There's obviously that undercurrent, and Matilda says she loves Leon, and
yeah, like, she says a couple of times, and it's in the theatrical version where there was enough there for me to be like, oh yeah, I can see how this kind of turns some heads a little bit, but mm-hmm. there are a couple scenes where she'll tell him, like, I'm in love with you. And she'll kind of look at him, like, longingly and kind of be like, huh, you're so interesting. Yeah. And then there's a scene where she tells the guy at the desk that she's like, oh, he's not my father, he's my lover. And which gets them kicked out of the hotel. Which, again, you can't tell. Matilda is kind of, like, she's a little scheming. She's kind of a punk. But there's definitely an undercurrent that she's in love with him. You don't feel it. You feel like there's a genuine sense of love on his part. Like, he does care for her. Mm-hmm. Obviously the feelings are not necessarily reciprocated, but if you wanted to look at this movie as that, there would be a solid argument. I think there would be a solid debate between two parties as to whether or not the film oversteps its boundaries. And I wonder, I know he buys a dress for her in the movie, in the one I saw, but she doesn't try it on. But I'm seeing that in the international version, she does try it on for him.
Okay. I mean, there's nothing much more than that. Like, she tries it on, and he goes, oh, you look beautiful. But, like, I think the thing is, like, I watched it, and my interpretation of it was really kind of like, you've got this young girl, and she's beyond her years, incredibly so. And that's because of the environment that she's been raised in. She's never got the chance to be a child or have that innocence, that she's surrounded by drugs, murder, death. Like, it was that scene where you were talking about where she comes in and she notices her family's been killed. Like, a young child would scream, would cry, would run away. Like, with her, she's like, I know how this story goes, and just walks, you know, she's trying to keep it cool. She walks to the neighbor and knocks on his door. You know, that it's things like that that tell me this is a character that, despite her age, is much older. And yeah, like, that was how I viewed it, like, that kind of her love for him was that she's out of sync with what her body and, you know, reality is, her age, that it's not perverted or sick the way it's interpreted. It's just telling you about this character that's never been allowed to be a child. She's, you know, we saw it with the school thing, she's not really been in the school system, there she is at the end. And there's so many kids like that. It's you know, when they've been or surrounded by adults, that's kind of how they act out. They act either wrong or, you know, towards people, disrespectful, or they've not gone through the system, or that they're just people that are just kind of completely out of sync with reality. And I think that's what it is.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I haven't, like you said, this is the first time we've watched it. I haven't really, like, I've researched it a little bit, but I haven't gotten a chance to watch any interviews with Bisson or, like, any behind the scenes stuff. I'd be very fascinated. I'm sure he doesn't come clean out and say, like, yeah, this is what I intended, because why would you? It's such a, like, it's one of those, like, red herrings where you could completely just let people pick, like, come up with whatever interpretation they want. But there are scenes where it's like he's in bed and she wakes up next to him and she's like in her PJs and she's like, hey, what's up? And it's like, yeah, I get where people are coming from. But as you're saying, she's been through a lot. She clearly has a crappy upbringing and hasn't had the chance to kind of function as a normal kid would. So you almost wonder about it. And I wonder, I mean, I honestly feel like I wish I'd watched the international cut, because there are a couple moments when he's training her and their relationship. It felt relatively well fleshed out, but it also felt a little bit rushed. And I'm wondering what else is in the extended version that isn't necessarily in the theatrical cut.
Yeah, you see them go around quite a lot. Like, it's almost, as I say, it's hard because I never watched your version. But like, yeah, like there's quite a bit of them kind of just doing the kind of like a bit of a training montage.
Yeah,
and,
like yeah, they're just going. That.
Yeah, they do those sort of things, and obviously there's a bit where they go to a dealer's house, and he's taken out, and they burn his drug stash, and
right.
You know, they take out someone. So yeah, I felt like I got kind of a good insight to that. I mean, obviously the biggest difference kind of in the training is like, you know, we see them with this Russian roulette scene, which I can really imagine why American audiences wouldn't want to watch that, where there's a she's got a gun and there's like one bullet in it, and she's like yeah, he's like, oh, I don't want to, I'm not interested in you, like, you know, you're a young child, and like he's like that kind of cold professional, you know. We see him kind of start to open up, and he's like, and then she's like, well, I'm gonna shoot myself, and this is Russian roulette, I could die here, you know, if I mean nothing to you, then don't stop me. And then she puts the gun to her head,
oh,
and
my
then
God.
He like pulls it away, and like a shot's fired, and it's that way of indicating that yeah, he does care for her, that he isn't just this cold professional, that he does have a heart as well. It's I can imagine American audiences going, what the hell is this?
Yeah, it's that sounds super intense.
Oh, it was you know, a young girl holding a gun to her head is like, okay, sure.
That sounds amazing. I wish I, like, honestly, I'm so bummed that I didn't watch that version of it, because that sounds crazy. But I'm also, so she, it feels like, I think, like you said, the difference, I think, is the way Leon reacts to her. He is acting very paternal. I think there is genuine love there as far as his the way he feels for her, but it's not really sexualized, and she is definitely sexualizing it. I think that's what makes people uncomfortable, is that it's like you put a young actress in a role like that and allow for those things to happen. But again, I don't know, I it does feel very much like Natalie Portman is so good in this role that you don't really think about it. Like, you don't really think about like, oh, this poor actress. She seems so like game and has such an understanding of what she's doing, that it never felt too uncomfortable for me, even when it was kind of pushing in that direction. I it never really bothered me all that much. I think if there's anything that kind of I felt kind of rushed was his decision to kind of train her. It felt like I kind of understood where the movie was going in its first act, and then the second act there was kind of an extended, like, okay, they're training, they're having fun, they're bonding, and all that stuff, and it kind of felt a little aimless to me. Like, when there's a scene, like, they're kind of enjoying each other's company, and then they cut to Gary Oldman coming back and, like, exploring the apartment and being like, oh, yeah, this is what happened, and she goes in there. And I remember thinking distinctly, I was like, oh, that's right. Like, let's get back to the plot of this. Did you feel that aimlessness, and was it like, was it more so in the international version? Like, did that give even more chance for the film to breathe? Because it sounds like it's a little bit more focused in some ways, even though it's longer.
I think the one thing that struck me was that the training theme seems to just kind of get accepted quite quickly, that this is what she wants and this is what they're going to do. Like, you watch and you think, oh, that was quick. He doesn't seem like, you know, you would imagine if you were that guy, like, putting your foot down and going, this is just simply not happening, you know, under any circumstances, regardless of how she acts. And I think the reaction towards the end when she turns up at the banker's house and he's like, oh, I want to be a cleaner, and he just screams at her, no, this is it, that's like, this is the end of that, that's not happening, you're off to school. And then the next scene she's at school, like, I was like, well, that's probably the realistic what would happen. Like, I think he accepts it far too easily, and then they're just sort of like off they go. Like, it's almost like he needs to accept it for the movie to begin, in a way.
Yeah, it's weird because it's like, there is an odd balance with this movie where Tarantino, and again, I bring him up because we just watched True Romance for the last episode of Missing Frames, but he is very stylized and it's very hyper real. this movie walks a weird line between hyper-real and reality. And it is interesting that you bring up the end scene where she's like, all right, I'll go back to school and it's okay. But I don't believe that character would be okay with that. I feel like she would find a way to, after everything she's been through, it feels very much like she wouldn't just settle for that ordinary life after all the training and just her in general, the way she responds to things and her very mature response to everything around her. And I wonder, and again, the relationship with the two of them, with Leon and Matilda, almost didn't feel... it felt necessary, obviously, to push the movie along, but I didn't get the sense early on that Leon felt lonely. I feel like it would have been better if we'd established a little bit stronger or more strongly that he was alone and that wasn't a state he was happy or comfortable in. You show him watching, like, he watches the Gene Kelly musical in the theater on his own, but at least in the theatrical version, he never takes Matilda with him to go see that.
No.
She sings the song to him. She sings Singing in the Rain, and that's when he wins the little game that they're playing. But I feel like you should have had a moment where it's like Leon's lonely. Like, he kind of looks around the theater, sees other couples, or sees like a father and his daughter, or something to kind of plant the seed that he wants that companionship.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can kind of fulfill that scene or pay it off in a later moment where maybe he takes Matilda to the theater and shares that with her. I think that's maybe now as we're discussing it, that might have been what my disconnect with the movie was. Is it kind of I loved their relationship and it was definitely emotionally affecting, but I wish I could have gotten a little bit more about Leon and his character and why he would take this girl in.
I think the one thing I kind of picked up from it was that in a way he falls into the role, kind of a bit of a kind of paternal role, quite quickly. That we see him at the beginning, he's this hitman, and then we see him having a bit of fun watching this Gene Kelly musical. And I don't know if it was in your version or not, but like when she's really upset that he talks about having this pig in the other room, I think it was, and then later on he's got like a kind of frog kind of hand puppet. And it's little things like that where he falls into that way quite quickly. And I think almost that his past with like his family, I think that almost just relit something that was already there that wasn't used. And in a way, perhaps that he wasn't lonely. He was just perhaps someone that, you know, a father, a kind of a lover, a husband, you know, someone that can care for someone, have attachments. And when the opportunity comes for that, it's a bit of a comfort blanket for him, and he doesn't almost need to overcome the loneliness. It's just something that he can now kind of fall into. I think that was sure. My feeling.
Yeah. So was there any hint that he had like a family life in the international version?
He talked about having like obviously his wife and
I didn't get any of that.
Oh,
I got
really?
None of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, I can't remember the full thing with the wife. He had a wife and I can't remember if it was a kid or not. He had a wife and that she had died. And I think that was kind of my interpretation. So it seems like there's quite a lot missing from the American version, and it's amazing that it's become a controversial movie in America for scenes that are in the international version in a way.
Yeah, well, I wonder if these scenes as you're describing them would have been better if they had been put in the movie, because again they don't establish Leon as anything but kind of a cipher. Like, he's kind of a mysterious guy, and he has those paternal instincts, but they're never really explained. He just kind of is like, oh yeah, I'll take care of this kid and I'll train her and everything. But they don't, I don't think, unless I missed it, I don't remember them ever mentioning he had a family or that there was a wife or that there was anything like that. And I feel like that would have only enriched the character and made it even more obvious, because from my perspective, it's a little bit creepier because he feels like it's a lonely guy. You don't know anything about him. It seems like this life has been his life forever. And he has this little girl in there and she's like, oh, I'm very much in love with you. And he's kind of like reacting in a way that's like, oh, my God, like this is you're 12 years old. Mm-hmm. But I think it would have made it more acceptable to American audiences if they had established that it's like, oh yeah, he had a wife, maybe he had a daughter, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. it's just some hint like that would have gone a long way into making it more comfortable. But maybe that's what Besson wanted. He wanted it to feel a little uncomfortable.
But then the international version is obviously the version that that was the version he wanted, so everyone else got to see what his version was, and then the rest of the, like, well, America got this kind of cut down version, but by all accounts I think they have both versions on the DVDs and Blu-rays, so that's a positive anyway.
Yeah, you can go back and watch, or I'll go back and watch the international, because I'm now very interested in seeing what that's like. But
there you go, Missing Frames 2.0, the international version.
Exactly, yes. So I mean, obviously audiences weren't the only ones uncomfortable with it, and critics, so Natalie Portman's parents, you were telling me, were very like, this is not happening. When she first, I heard she read the script and was like, I love it. And her parents were like, no, you don't.
The bits that were quite amusing that her parents took issue with, you know, obviously she smokes. You never actually see her inhale or exhale. And she's only allowed to smoke 5 times and she has to give up smoking. And that was part of their obligation, like before she signed up for the movie. So when you watch the movie, that all happens, that because I checked up on the facts after I'd watched the movie while you went to the bathroom, Sean, and and I looked at that, and that was it, the one of the deals with the smoking, and you kind of, you always get the impression she smokes, but you never actually see her, you know, doing the exhaling and inhaling.
Yeah, and that would also be a funny character thing. Like, it's like she has a cigarette but she never smokes it. She's like Will Smith. She just lights it. It's for the look. She totally is ripping off Getting Jiggy With It, or maybe Getting Jiggy With It is, are you following anything I'm saying right now with Will Smith?
I'm just nodding.
Is this...
no.
But yeah, I think that would be funny if that was her character. Like, if she just lights cigarettes, but she doesn't necessarily smoke them. And I also hear there was a scene that was not in the movie, that was not filmed, where Leon walks in on her in the shower.
Oh, yes. I heard about that one. I think that was at the script stage, thankfully. So, yeah, that was definitely not in our version. At one point she says, I'm off for a shower, but that's it, thankfully.
Yeah, and yeah, I wish, again, the scene where she puts on the dress, I wish I had seen that. Like, that sounds like a very, just an interesting, and again, a more firm, like, no, you're a kid, this is not what you think it is, that kind of thing, which was kind of missing from the theatrical version. But I also hear that Besson didn't let them rehearse that scene. He wanted them to feel really awkward about the moment, and apparently that comes across very naturally in the film.
Yeah, and I think that does, because I think, like, Jean Renault was talking about that, he's, as a character, like, in the movies before, he'd been quite a calm, relaxed, internal person, and he felt that was why he could do this sort of movie, that there's this young girl that's in a way throwing herself at him, and he's able to kind of, like, you watch it and you're never in any doubt that's not ever going to happen for him, but he does care for her. So you see that internal process, where sometimes you need that sort of brick wall, especially when someone's kind of all over you, just to sort of, you're never in doubt of, like, wait, where's this going? I never once thought he had any kind of designs on her other than being caring.
No, he felt, you know, he felt a little mentally, like, a little slow, I guess, which I think is how Renault played him. I think that was purposeful. I guess you could confuse that with, like, thoughtful, like, oh, this girl, maybe I do love her. But it did strike me that he was a little off as far as mentally, which, again, if you wanted to look into that and say, like, oh, yeah, he's a pervert or whatever, I guess you could. But the movie never reinforces that idea. Like we were saying, it is always pushing for, like, she is totally all over him, and he's always kind of like, no, no, no. And, the international cut, honestly, it's funny that they're like, oh, take out that Russian roulette scene. It probably would have been a little better to have these moments in the movie. So as far as, like, favorite moments go, favorite scenes or things that stand out to you, like, if you were to try to sell this to someone who's like, okay, spoil any particular moment in this movie for me to win me over to watching it. What do you think? What would you pick?
I like any scene that Gary Oldman comes into, because you've got this like thoughtful story going on with Matilda and Leon, and just every time he comes in, it almost seems to take the movie from this like intimate relationship kind of drama, and then it explodes it into something that's a bit more kind of wacky in a way. Like even at the end where you've got his character, and he almost has an entire police force to kill Leon, and it's just like, it's so out of sync with what the movie has been like that you're like,
yeah, of course
that's what happens in like James Bond or something. You get the entire militia appear trying to take out this one man, and they just send them to an apartment. I'm like, okay. And I find that's an interesting tell, probably for the career he's about to have, where there's subtle things going on, and then there's almost part of him that's like, how can I push this to the most ridiculous level? It's not like five hitmen are coming in. I want like an entire like department of police officers coming down on this guy. And I find that an interesting tell for things to come. But I think any scene with Portman is just amazing. I think she's
incredible in that. Gold.
It's crazy. I mean, I think it sums up directors in a way as well, the scenes with her, because in a few years' time, she ends up being cast in The Phantom Menace, and she's by no means the worst thing in it, but she's really wooden, and like obviously her career after the Star Wars prequels was on shaky ground for a little while. Like people didn't want to work with her, and she found herself kind of cut out, and then she picked some good roles, some directors took a chance on her, and it's so good to see that her career, like she's always surrounded herself by good directors, and I think in Leon that I can't think of a better person that helped her through that role, because he is great with female actors for the most part in terms of his movies, in terms of their performances. So yeah, I think it would have to be all her scenes and Oldman.
Yeah, I, you know, it's funny, I heard that Natalie Portman, when she was on the set for Phantom Menace, because she was only like, it was only a couple years after this. I mean, this was 1994. She's playing a 12-year-old. Yeah, I think she's playing a 14-year-old in Phantom Menace. But she basically, I heard, and it's funny because you can tell, apparently she would just cry all the time on set because she didn't want to be there and she wanted to be like playing with her friends. And there are a couple shots where you can see she kind of has this like watery eyed expression and you have to wonder. But it is a shame. I mean, it's funny how she is technically a child actor and we don't really think of her as a child actor. I know I don't. She kind of... to me, I'd seen her in Star Wars, and then I'd seen her in like Black Swan and other movies where, you know, she was an adult playing very adult roles. But this was her first movie. Leon the Professional was her first movie, and she's already so like, aware of her craft, and so she's already pretty much mastered it as a young kid. It's hard to remember it. It's hard to think of her as a child actor because she's so good.
Yeah. And I mean, that's like why I struggled. I watched it and thinking, like, even appearance wise, she still looks like the Natalie Portman like 20 years on that we see in that movie, just a little bit taller and a little. And that was difficult in a way. As I say, I struggled to not think of her as an adult actor pretending that she was a young kid.
Yeah, no, me too. And I think, man, if I were to pick a scene in this movie that I would use to sell the movie, it's that scene you were describing, the Gary Oldman like out sending the police force in to get Leon and that escape from the building. That was pretty great. And I also loved, I mean, I loved the opening scene too. The scenes with Leon, he's very sensitive and thoughtful. I mean, he owns a plant, for crying out loud, that he calls his best friend. But he is, when he goes into assassin mode, he's like full on, like, you don't want to mess with this guy, which is great because you spend so much time with him as a normal guy that you start to forget how dangerous he is. At least you get hints of it in the international version, it sounds like. For me, there's a whole stretch of the movie where he is not killing anybody. He's not doing anything related to his work. He goes off and then he comes back and he's a little bit bloodied up, but that's all I got. So for me, when you get that kind of very fulfilling climax in the movie where it's like he is he's taken down all the police and he's like they're coming into his apartment and he's taking them all out, that felt very fulfilling because at that point in the movie you kind of have forgotten that he is he's so dangerous and that he's so good at his job, that he's such a professional, I would go ahead and say.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like you need to watch this movie again. Like, it sounds like, yeah then I couldn't imagine watching. Like, it's a 25 minutes extra footage. It's quite an experience more, because I remember watching it in the morning thinking, right, like, which version am I going to watch here? And I was like, oh, I might as well watch the longer version. That's bound to be the best and stuff. And it certainly sounds like it.
It does sound like it is. Although I would watch I would encourage you to watch the theatrical version just to kind of see. It would be interesting to compare and contrast and see, like, okay, yeah, this would work better, or I understand why they took this out. Because to me, honestly, I can't think of anything in the version I watched that necessarily improves the movie. But it's got to be worth watching regardless.
Yeah, definitely. Like, yeah, at the end of the day, what wrong can you do? Like, it's always interesting to watch these different cuts that it maybe set, like, watching the American cut probably tells you a lot more about American audiences, and like then the international one tells you a lot about how kind of the more kind of nuanced international audiences, the Europeans perhaps, view the story of this young kid. It's quite interesting, I think.
Yeah, so what do you say out of the three movies we've seen Jean Reno in, which are, for me, are Mission Impossible? I think we've seen the same movies, Mission Impossible, Godzilla, and now Leon the Professional. What do you think is his best?
You'd have to kind of say this one. He's the starring man. He's the, you know, and the other ones, like, he's kind of got a backing role. He's, you know, he's second to Tom Cruise, and you can argue he's second to Natalie Portman in this, but like, they complement each other so well. Natalie Portman's character wouldn't be as strong without this character to kind of rage against and to hit off, and the fact that you can see why this character kind of loves this guy. I mean, I'm not meaning, you know, love as in love, like, you know, she sums up brilliantly one point, and I don't know if it was in the your cut or not, but there's a point where she goes, I love you, and he goes, well, how can you know that, like, you're so young, you've never been in love, and she goes, I feel it, and he goes, where do you feel it? And then you see her, like, her bare stomach and her hands going down, you're like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah,
and
then I did have that scene,
She points to the stomach, and I was like, whew, and that sums it up in a way, I think. Yeah, like, you know, how you probably, that could go is, you know, sums it up, I think.
Yeah, I think I think the entire movie is him playing a game with the audience, because it's like, I think, you know, everyone in the audience is like, but everyone in the audience is also thinking of the movie that way, like in their relationship, like, oh, it's something perverted and dirty. But then when you look at the facts and what she's actually doing and saying and what he's doing and saying, you'll find that it's actually a lot more touching than that. Mm-hmm. Well, you did pass. You passed the question. Between Mission Impossible, Godzilla, and Leon the Professional, this is easily his best role. Although I will say, I think it's kind of funny that in Mission Impossible, he plays a very similar character, and I wonder if that was purposeful.
Yeah, I think he was typecast. You know, I think this was his first real American movie that, oh, yeah, the French hitman and stuff like that. Yeah, we'll go with that.
I kind of wish they named his character Leon, though. That would have been a nice little homage.
Exactly.
Although
or
it is, it,
Leone,
it's a little,
or something.
It is a little depressing to think that Leon would meet his end in a helicopter trying to chop Tom Cruise to death. It feels a little underwhelming based on what we know about the character.
Exactly, yeah. But hey, it'll do.
All right, so final thoughts, final ratings. So on a scale of, I'm going to say, and if you have a better rating scale, feel free to go for it. So on a scale of 1 to 5, Eric, Sarah, GoldenEye soundtracks, what would you give Leon the Professional?
I'm a 5 rater myself as well. So I would give it a 4. I mean, solely based on the performances. And I think, like, I'm not going to forget about watching this movie and what it made me think. And the first time I got to podcast with you was about this movie. So it's going to have all these different meanings to me. And I think the performances alone deserve all that. Like, as an action movie or whatever, it's like, yeah, run of the mill. Yeah, middle of the road. That's fine. But in terms of, like, a unique story and a provocative story and everything that goes along with it, I would have to give it a strong 4.
Yeah, I'd probably go ahead and give it a strong 3. It's like right in the middle for me, where I'm leaning towards the side of I enjoyed it, but it's almost like, and again, I want to watch the international cut because I feel like it might fill in a lot of the blanks that I felt were missing from this version of it. But it felt very like I was kind of missing a little bit more from his character, maybe a bit more depth. And then the whole second act of the movie, because it didn't, my version didn't have the scenes of them training as much or going off and doing those things, or the Russian roulette scene, it felt like there was a definite lack of tension and focus in the second act. But overall, it's a striking movie. It's a memorable movie. It's no, I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all that this has such a reputation, because it has so many elements that are so fascinating and memorable. I mean, if anything, it makes me want to watch like The Fifth Element and Besson's other movies too, just to kind of see where he went, especially Valerian. Let's just you know, go watch Valerian, give him 200, give this guy $200 million to make a ridiculous sci-fi movie. I'd say solid three. I really, really enjoyed it, but yeah, so I mean, that's it. We've done it. We've covered this movie. I think we've done a fantastic job. Lee, thank you so much for joining me.
No, a pleasure. Thank
episode.
You so much for having me. You've got a great show and a great, you know, great thing going on. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And likewise. And I hope we can kind of continue to cross the streams a little bit more as well. And everyone, you can find Lee on Filibuster, and it's a fantastic show. Lots of cool stuff coming up. What's coming up on Filibuster?
Yeah, we've got it. We're going to be interviewing Robert Picardo, Sylvester McCoy, and we've got a couple of other guests coming up. I don't want to spoil one of them because I've got one definitely in the bag. But we've got some, you know, we've asked people what's like working with Christopher Nolan, working with Peter Jackson, James Cameron. Touch wood, we should be asking someone pretty shortly what it was like to work with Nicholas Winding Refn. So that's something hopefully exciting to bring you soon.
It's great. And by the time this episode airs, you should have access to at least a couple of those interviews. So make sure you're checking out the show. And Lee, where can people find you on the Twitter?
Yeah, you can find me at Lee_Nostromo. And yeah, you can find me under that on Instagram as well.
And you can find me on Twitter at @YeChandorman. Feel free to follow both of us. Chat with us about Leon the Professional. Which cut do you prefer of the movie? Is International the way to go? It sounds like it is. And then make sure you're also following at @JoinNerdParty. Make sure to go to thenerdparty.com. Check out all the great shows we have there. And other than that, we will see you next time on Missing Frames. Lee, thank you so much again.
No problem at all. Thank you very much.
And we will see you, the audience, somewhere out there. I don't know why that became an American Tale quote. I'm not sure what happened.